Thanks, AJ. It's not exactly what's in your proceedings. I have a tendency to dink around with the slides. I'm never happy with the presentation, so this will be a little bit different than what's in your presentation, but I think we'll be okay. So I've been asked to talk about reproductive and other emerging diseases, and when we talk about reproductive diseases, as you all know, typically it shows up at maybe preg check time when the veterinarian comes out and starts preg checking, and you've got more opens than normal, maybe some late breeders, or for those producers that do not preg check, they start calving and they realize that they're not having very many calves during the early part of the calving season. But the third time that we actually start thinking about reproductive diseases is when producers start having abortions. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that today and show you some trends through the diagnostic lab at K-State. And this is for the last 4 years. And every year represents 200 to 300 different abortion cases that we work up. And on the left-hand column there, those are all an example of the definitive diagnosis that we can get from an abortion. So it's anything from nutritional to nitrate toxicosis to some of the diseases like lepto, anaplasm, BVD. And I just want to show you that there's a whole range of definitive diagnoses for abortions. The unfortunate thing about abortion workups is that for any single workup, meaning any single fetus that is presented for an abortion workup, we're only going to get a diagnosis about 30 to 42% of the time. And that's not just our laboratory, but that's basically nationwide. Diagnostics in abortion workups are very, very difficult. Even so, we do get some information from that. So I just picked some of these off the left-hand side to talk about today. Could have talked about all of them, but I just picked some ones that have particular interest in. So we talk about the three big ones for contagious bacterial abortions. And again, this goes back 4 years. Campylobacter, and I'll talk a little bit about that here in a minute. You can see kind of the trend for 2014 through 2016. Anaplasm, I'll talk a little bit about anaplasm. We don't normally talk about anaplasm as a fertility or a reproductive issue, but actually it is. Lepto, I'm just showing you the lepto there. I'm not going to talk about lepto today. It's kind of a different organism to talk about. So just a little summary for Campylobacter. It's when we have vaccines with the V, so it's like Cattlemaster 4 VL5 or PregGuard 10 VL5. The V in there stands for Vibrio, which is the old name for Campylobacter. And it's a bacteria, it's a venereal transmission, just like Trich is, and it's known to cause infertility, early embryonic death, and then abortion. So it can be involved with the entire gamut of reproductive issues. Anaplasmosis, and we spent a lot of time talking about anaplasm in Kansas for the last 2 years. As I think you all know, it's an insect-transmitted disease. Anytime we move blood from a positive animal to a negative animal, we have the opportunity to pass the disease along. And those insects are typically ticks, not all ticks, but some ticks, stable flies, horse flies, and deer flies are vectors for this disease. In herds that are already positive, we do know that not using needles, multiple-use needles, is a really good way of transmitting anaplasmosis from positive cows to negative cows. Late-term abortions and stillbirths. So that's typically what we see when we have an anaplasmosis issue. It's typically not a fertility issue, nor is it an early embryonic death, but it's primarily the late-term abortions and stillborns. This is obviously a map of Kansas, and this is represents the counties where there's been at least one herd diagnosed with anaplasmosis in 2017. I don't know if you can see the numbers inside the dots, but the numbers represent the number of unique herds within that county that are positive for anaplasmosis. So this doesn't tell you where the disease isn't, but it does tell you where the disease is. And I think we're safe to say that at least for the last 2 years, the eastern two-thirds of Kansas, probably every single county, has at least one positive anaplasmosis herd. Like I talked about earlier, late-term abortions, 2014, 2015, we actually investigated four herds that had anaplasmosis-associated abortions. Our pathologists talk about the reason we see abortions from anaplasmosis. We'll see it in cows when they become very anemic due to anaplasmosis. Therefore, we're not sending enough oxygen to the fetus, and the fetus goes through a period of actual oxygen deprivation, dies, and then we actually have the abortion. We also see it in cows that are not anemic, and our pathologists believe that actually what happens then is that these animals are passing enough bacteria through the placenta to the calf to cause a septicemia or a bacteria in the bloodstream, and then we have organ failure, and then we have fetal death. So I went back and looked in the literature to try to find some proof that actually there is an association between anaplasm and abortions. An old study in 75 listed on there, they took six intact cows. When you hear intact cows in anaplasm, that means their spleen is still there, because the spleen is very, very important for helping control this disease. And we have to be very, very careful when we look at research on anaplasm, because a lot of animals that are used actually have their spleens removed, which is not a normal thing in the field, as you know. But they took six intact cows, inoculated, meaning they took blood from a positive animal, injected into these animals, and four of those cows aborted. Another study inoculated nine intact cows, and six of those aborted 22 to 31 days later. There at the bottom, recently we've been working with a veterinarian in a surrounding state who has a client with 46 fall cows, and they were checked on Sunday, and everybody was fine. They rechecked them on Wednesday, and they found three dead cows. Veterinarian went out, posted two of them. Was actually definitively diagnosed as being anaplasm, and then some abortions started. We're still working it up, but they've had nine abortions. One we'd probably call a stillborn, but it looks like this is definitely an anaplasmosis-associated abortion. So I just wanted to bring that out today, that that's not typically a disease we think of as a reproductive issue, but it certainly can be. Viral abortions, the two that are out there are IBR and BVD, and we'll talk about both of those here, and you can kind of see the pattern for both of those. Remember this pattern here, where you can see since 2014 there's been a huge increase in the number of IBR abortions that we've actually diagnosed. And it is the number one cause of abortion that we find in the laboratory, and has been for the last 3 years. So IBR, it's infectious bovine rhinotracheitis is the name. As you all know, it's a respiratory and a reproductive organism. It's part of the BRD complex also. Transmission is through aerosols. Just breathing is enough to transmit it. Any fluid transmission, we're talking about uterine fluids, vaginal fluids, can pass this disease off to other animals. This is a herpes virus, so there's a lot of animals out there that are positive but do not show signs. It's very similar to the shingles in humans. Humans have the virus, and then a few humans will break out with the clinical signs of shingles. That's same class of organism as this one is. Like I showed in the previous slide, we've seen a huge increase in the number of IBR abortions. And until just recently, one of the beliefs was that because of the number of labeled vaccines out there for use of modified live vaccines in pregnant cows, that maybe the IBR fraction of the vaccine was actually causing the issue. Recently, we've got the technology in our laboratory to compare the IBR virus that we find in the fetus or the placenta to the strain in the vaccines. And we haven't looked at all of them, but we've gone back and looked at several. And there are some of those fetuses, the virus in that fetus is identical to the virus that's in the vaccine. We're not saying don't use modified live vaccine on pregnant animals. We're just saying please follow labeled instructions. It's very, very important you do that so that we do not cause an IBR abortions in our cow herds. The other thing I just want to mention is, you know, we think if we vaccinate an animal, they're automatically going to mount an immune response and everything's going to be good. But I'm pretty sure that if we vaccinated 100 calves or 100 cows and we went back and tested those animals, there's going to be a certain percentage of those animals that did not respond. So, again, I'm not saying don't use modified live and pregnant cows or heifers, but just make sure you follow labeled directions and use your veterinarian's advice. BVD. Boy, we've talked a lot about BVD, bovine viral diarrhea virus. It's just like IBR. It's both a respiratory and a reproductive organism. Transmission, just like IBR, is aerosols or any fluid, saliva, vaginal secretions, semen, uterine secretions. They all can transmit or actually carry the BVD virus. We talk a lot about persistently infected animals and transiently infected animals. And we've always talked about the thing that we have to prevent from being a cow-calf herd is our persistently infected calves. Those are calves that are born with BVD. They have a huge amount of virus in all their systems. So anybody that they're exposed to, they're exposing those animals to huge doses of this BVD virus. TIs are transiently infected. They're not born with the disease, but they're infected for a short period of time. If they're exposed to animals, they can also transmit the disease, but their viral load is a lot less than PIs. So it's important that we try to prevent both PIs and TIs from getting into the cow-calf operation. Look up here on the horizontal axis there. This is the month of gestation when a fetus is exposed to BVDV. And then the bars represent what could happen to that fetus. And you see abortion. If that fetus is exposed to it in utero from 2 months all the way out to term, there's an opportunity for that calf to be aborted. Again, the one that we talk about the most, there's that 40 to 120 days. If that fetus is exposed to BVD during that time and it survives, then there's an opportunity that that calf will be born a PI. Dr. Sandy Johnson brought this attention to me and said, you know, we talk a lot about PIs and we talk a lot about abortions, but we don't talk very much about the effect that BVD has on fertility and early embryonic death. And so I went back and looked in the literature to try to find some documentation that, yes, BVD does have an effect on fertility and early embryonic death. So I'm just going to show you a couple studies. I looked for studies where there was natural exposure, where we weren't artificially causing these animals to be infected. And the first one, they took a group of seronegative cows, meaning these animals had not been exposed to BVD, and then they exposed them to actually a PI cow and a PI calf during breeding. And what they found was, if you on the top there, those that seroconverted, meaning those that were exposed and developed an immune response before season, meaning they were exposed and mounted an immune system during the breeding season itself, their pregnancy rate was 44.4. For those cows that were exposed but did not mount an immune response until after the breeding season, their preg rate was 22.2%. So BVD, at least in this study, showed that fertility had a huge, or embryonic death, either one, had a huge impact on these herds. Another study where they actually took heifers, seronegative heifers, again, heifers that were never exposed to BVD. Then they exposed these group, one group to PI animals, one group not to PI animals. And what they found was that those heifers that were exposed to a PI 4 days after insemination, their preg rate was 44%. The group that was not exposed to PI animal, their preg rate was 79%. And they used hormonal assays at 22 days or 20 days after breeding to determine whether they're pregnant or not. The cool thing about this study was that they actually came back 77 days post-insemination and ultrasounded. And what they found was the exposed group lost an additional 11% of their fetuses from 20 days to 77 days. The group that was not exposed to the PI animals did not lose any of their fetuses. So I think it, at least from these two studies, and they're well done with quite a large number of animals, that BVD does have an effect on fertility and early embryonic death. Just want to show you every dot on there from 2015 to 2017 is a county in Kansas where at least one persistently infected animal has been identified. I tried to take out all the feedlots and the dairy here, so this should represent cow-calf operations. I'm sure I made a mistake here and there, but I just want to show you this, that we still have PI animals in our cow-calf herds, even though we're doing a good job of vaccinating and with biosecurity and those kind of things. Here's one of particular interest. I know Dr. Coover really has an interest in this also. It's Neospora caninum. I call it Neospora, but it's Neospora. This is a protozoa. You can see the trends. We diagnose quite a few Neospora or Neospora abortions every year through our laboratory. Just want to talk a little bit about this organism. Like I said, the name is Neospora caninum. We can have both horizontal and vertical transmission of this disease. And when we talk about horizontal, we're talking about from animal to animal. We talk about vertical, we're talking about from dam to calf. So for this disease, we can have both going on at the same time in a herd. The thing about this disease is that there's several outcomes for a fetus that becomes infected. The downside is it's a carrier for life. And we'll talk about how it has the opportunity of then passing that disease on to any calves that it actually has later in life. And then, of course, we can have abortion. So those are all the four outcomes that we can have from a calf that becomes infected in utero. This is just a picture to show you the life cycle. And the reason this is important is that canines, both domestic and coyotes, are known to be what we call definitive hosts, meaning they take this organism in, the organism replicates or reproduces, the coyote or the dog defecates, these organisms are in the feces then can contaminate water or feed these animals in the center there, dogs, sheep, horses, goats, cattle. If they ingest these organisms, that's the way they become infected. That's horizontal transmission. Over there on the left-hand side, if she actually happens to ingest these organisms either through water or feed and she's pregnant, then she has the opportunity to pass this organism off to her fetus. That's vertical transmission. So we have both of those things going on at the same time. So one of the risk factors for herds that are positive for Neospora are number of dogs that are there because, like I said, some are carriers. But there's also studies that show that the number of birds in the area also is a risk factor. So I'm not sure we know that much about this disease, but it's definitely an important one. Some of the research out there that's looked at this disease, and I know of at least 25 studies that looked at animals that were positive on a blood test, meaning they've been exposed, they do have antibodies to this organism, they're 2 to 3 times more likely to abort compared to animals, dams that were not exposed to this organism. Abortion risk decreases by dam parity. There's lots of good research out there that shows, at least in herds that are not newly infected, as that animal, cow or heifer, becomes older, even though she remains positive, she'll remain positive for her entire life, her opportunity for aborting actually decreases through time. There's a couple scenarios that we see with this disease. One of them is for herds that are newly infected, meaning somehow we got some feces from a canine of some sort into the feed or the water. Typically what we see in those herds are epidemic abortions. a large number of animals all around the same time will start aborting. For herds that are positive, that have been positive for years or for some time, typically it presents itself as just a nagging decrease in fertility, maybe a little higher abortion rate than normal. And it's not every year. It just seems like it waxes and wanes. So there's a couple scenarios for this particular disease. I'm hoping that as we think about this disease more often, that we're going to start studying it more. The thing that bothers me about those numbers that I showed you up here is that I said that most of the calves that are born or exposed to this disease are born normally. And so a lot of times when we see aborted fetuses come to the diagnostic lab and we find Neospora, we automatically say that's the cause of the abortion. But I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think maybe it's overrepresented sometimes. And so I like to be very, very careful about saying that just because we find this organism in a fetus, that's the reason it died. There should be other pathology to back that up. Okay. So other emerging diseases, and I don't know if they're really emerging, but it's kind of a cool word, so we threw it in there. One is bovine leucosis virus. How many of you heard of BLV? Yeah, everybody, right? So I just want to look at the bottom there. National Animal Health Monitoring System, they did a study in a nationwide cow-calf study in 1999, and they found 39% of the cow-calf herds that they looked at were positive for BLV. They came back and did a dairy study in 2007. They found 83% of all the dairy herds in the United States that they studied actually had BLV. This is what BLV looks like in Kansas. So this is for the last 3 years, and these are counties, again, where there's at least one animal and one herd that's BLV positive. And the reason I bring this up is that this is a lymphoma from bovine leucosis virus. Start doing some testing, and people are really amazed on what percentage of their herd actually is positive for BLV. There's lots of herds that are almost entirely, all their animals are positive. So it's a huge issue. It's very, very prevalent, at least in the state of Kansas. A little bit about it. It's a tumor-causing virus. We typically, animals that the median age when we start seeing those tumors is 5 years of age. So we're not going to see it in young animals. We're going to see it in older animals. It's not really been associated with reproduction. It's been studied a lot on the dairy side. It's primarily associated with premature culling and reduced production. But I want to throw this out because I think it's kind of an enlightening study. So these researchers went back in the Freedom of Information Act, and they looked at slaughtered coal cows from 2003 to 2007. And they looked at records for 26 million cows that were slaughtered in the U.S. And of those, a little over 500,000 of those cows were condemned after they were stunned and bled out and hanging on the rail. And the number one reason why those animals were condemned after slaughter was because of lymphoma, which is the tumor caused by BLV. So these animals did not show clinical signs when they went to the slaughterhouse, but they were found to carry this virus or these tumors after slaughter. What's the number one reason why, in this study, why cows were condemned before they even made it into the packing plant? Mark Spear. Yeah, so, you know, usually the answer is, well, they're down because we can't slaughter down cows. The number one reason why cows in this study did not make it into the slaughter plant is because they were dead on the truck upon arrival. That's quite a thing to say, right? Okay, the other reason I bring this up top hand right there, zoonotic potential, meaning, is there the potential that this virus can be transmitted from animals to humans? And I'm just bringing this up that over the last couple years, several studies on the human side of medicine have been able to find live bovine leucosis virus in both male and female human mammary tumors. And so I just want to put that out there that if people start talking about the zoonotic potential of this virus, that maybe we should start thinking about maybe controlling it. Last disease I'm going to go over is Yoni's disease. It's caused by an organism, Mycobacterium avian subspecies parapetuberculosis. I don't know why we do that, but we do. We just call it MAP. It's not associated with reproductive diseases either, except for in cows in the later stages of the disease. But here is a map of Kansas to show you the positive cow-calf herds that we know of that have at least one Yoni's positive animal. Some of these are commercial. Some of these are purebred animals. And the only reason I bring this up is that, again, is there a zoonotic potential? There's been a loud drumbeat for a long time with people trying to make the association between exposure to this organism, either through red meat, milk, water, and Crohn's disease in humans. And the drumbeat's getting very, very loud. Just recently, there's been a drumbeat started where people are associating this organism with juvenile autism. And then after that, there's been some medical doctors that have tried to make the association between this disease and diabetes. There's never been anybody that has shown that this organism causes these diseases, but there's enough people on the human side of medicine that believe they're associated that, again, this may be another disease that, at least as an industry, we might want to think about controlling or at least say that we're trying to put things in place to try to control this disease. We certainly don't want to decrease consumer confidence in the product that we make. So that's all I'm going to say about Yoni's. It's quite an interesting disease also. That's all I have. I don't know if there's time for questions or not. Probably not.